sidewalk. What does he say? I'm not going to have this conversation now. By blotting out the rest of the scene and highlighting that interaction, what we do is raise the issue of complicity. And the fact that Officer Tao is as complicit in the murder of George Floyd as Derek Chauvin, because he allowed it to happen within feet of him, when he is being told by people to simply check the pulse of a man who had yet to move and who didn't appear to be breathing. He refused to do that. He refused to intervene. And as a result of his, you know, complicity, as well as the complicity of other officers who were there, George Floyd lost his life. That scene could have ended so much, it could have ended differently. But none of them were able to gin up the courage to say stop to Derek Chauvin.
Finally, we just have a minute, but this is the fourth anniversary of the murder of George Floyd by police. It's also this season of violent police crackdowns on the Gaza encampments.
So what we see in the crackdown on these encampments, what we see in the crackdown on, you know, of unrest on the streets here and in other places is simply the logical outcome of the origins of our police. They were always formed with the idea that violence to contain and control a disorderly public is at the heart of policing's function in this country. And so when we see, you know, the most professional police department in the world, the NYPD, swinging clubs and swinging fists and throwing people to the ground as
you
a way
are listening
of,
to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO, independent radio since 1968. Support our station and fight the status quo by donating to our spring membership drive now through May 25th. During our last week, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar, up to $20,000, thanks to a group of anonymous donors. Click on the red button on the top corner of the app to donate. Thanks.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, more primary election results in Oregon paint a clearer picture of some runoff races in November. A survey reveals who people trust to make policy around cannabis legalization. And in national news, the ticketing giant Live Nation could be broken up by federal authorities. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 23rd, 2024. KBOO is in the final days of our spring membership drive, so we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to bit.ly/KBOO. I'm Michelle Coppola. Well, we're 2 days out from Oregon's primary election on Tuesday, and more winners and future matchups are becoming clear. 4 seats in the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners were open in this primary. Just one, District 3, had a clear winner. Julia Brim Edwards will maintain her seat next term. But in the other districts, one candidate didn't get more than 50% of the vote, so there will be a runoff election in November. In District 1, Megan Moyer will face Vadim Mazierski. Moyer has captured 46% of the vote so far to Mazierski's 40%. In District 2, Shannon Singleton has 46% of the vote so far. It's not yet known if Singleton will face business owner Jesse Burke or former Portland Mayor Sam Adams in the November contest. The District 4 candidates could potentially see a runoff, but Vince Jones-Dixon has 49.93% of the vote, with more ballots still being counted. On the county level, District Attorney challenger Nathan Vasquez unseated current DA Mike Schmidt, but he says he won't ask Schmidt to resign in order for him to take office early. On the state level, the Secretary of State race will be between Democrat Tobias Reed and Republican Dennis Linthicum. Linthicum is one of the Republican state legislators who is barred from running for re-election because of his extended walkout absences in 2022. Brian Boquist is in the same boat, so he's running for Oregon Treasurer against Democrat Elizabeth Steiner. Democrats have held that seat for more than 30 years. Oregon Attorney General is also on the ballot this November. Democrat Dan Rayfield will face Republican Will Lathrop. Also a result of this week's election, Crook County, Oregon, a central Oregon county east of Bend, voted on a measure to allow the county to join the Greater Idaho Movement. They're the 13th Oregon county to do so. The measure passed with 53% of voters saying yes, that the county should look into relocating the Idaho border. Crook County also rejected a school bond measure to improve safety and repair their local schools. Final election results won't be certified until next month, and more votes that were cast by mail are still being counted. A new study suggests that people don't trust major corporations, lobbies, or big pharma to make marijuana policy. The survey is titled, American Values and Beliefs About Marijuana Legalization. KBOO's Doug McVeigh spoke with the researchers to learn more.
New research finds that when it comes to formulating policies around legal marijuana, people trust marijuana users much more than they do big alcohol, big tobacco, or big pharma. That's according to the results of a survey conducted by nonprofit think tank Parabola Center in collaboration with the independent research institute RTI International. To find out more, I spoke with Shalene Tidle, founder and director of Parabola Center.
We did this study because we actually wanted to measure the effectiveness of some educational videos we had put together. So we collaborated with RTI, a research institute, to ask them to use surveys to see how effective the videos were. And part of that was to divide people into two groups and ask all of them some questions about what they thought about legalization, who should benefit and who shouldn't benefit, whom do they trust and not trust, and then what values do they hold. So we were so taken aback by the strong agreement that we saw in those surveys, even before any of them had watched educational videos, that we thought it would be useful to put out to the public. So our key findings were that first, American adults do not trust tobacco, alcohol, or pharmaceutical executives to create good cannabis policy. Less than a quarter of the respondents would trust those executives, which was interesting because we know that they're spending a lot of money on lobbying at the federal level currently. We found that more than two-thirds trust people with lived experience, and a majority trust people who actually use marijuana to come up with good cannabis policy. We also looked at who American adults believe cannabis legalization should benefit. The vast majority thought that people who use medical marijuana should benefit, 83%. And then a majority thought that locally owned businesses and small businesses should benefit from legalization. A large percentage, 73%, thought that workers in the cannabis industry should benefit from cannabis legalization. But only a minority thought that pharmaceutical, tobacco, alcohol companies should benefit, or large corporate actors. And then finally, when we asked respondents what they care about, their values and concerns when it comes to cannabis policy, social equity ranked the highest, equal with ending arrests at 68%. Social equity was defined for respondents as the idea that we should try to repair some of the harms caused by past enforcement of marijuana laws. The lowest ranked value when it comes to cannabis policy was keeping marijuana illegal. That was 27%, in line with what we've seen with Gallup polls and others showing around 70% support for legalization. But we found that other surveys and polls haven't dug into why people support legalization or who they trust. So our hope is that these findings will encourage the public and policymakers to think more critically about who will benefit from different types of cannabis policy reform, whether it's criminal justice or economic justice, or just a corporate free-for-all. These all have different implications. And so we hope people will think about those nuances rather than lumping all marijuana-related reform together.
That was Shalene Tidle, founder and director of the nonprofit think tank Parabola Center. Their new survey entitled American Values and Beliefs About Marijuana Legalization is available on the web at parabolacenter.org. Reporting for KBOO News, I'm Doug McVeigh.
The U.S. Department of Justice has announced they will sue to break up Live Nation, the parent company of Ticketmaster. That follows an investigation into their business practices in 2022, which included allegations of antitrust violations that surged with the company's handling of Taylor Swift's Eras Tour. Last November, the website failed to accommodate the unprecedented demand for the tour. Fans expressed a host of frustrations with Ticketmaster, including invalid codes to buy tickets, website crashes, and costly processing fees. The subsequent public debate sparked newfound scrutiny into Ticketmaster's acquisition of former ticketing rival Live Nation as a possible violation of antitrust law. Antitrust laws are those that regulate businesses to keep them from creating monopolies in their industries or engaging in anti-competitive practices. Through Ticketmaster, Live Nation controls around 80% of major concert venues' ticketing for concerts. That's according to the complaint. Attorney General Merrick Garland wrote in a statement, quote, "We allege that Live Nation relies on unlawful, anti-competitive conduct to exercise its monopolistic control over the live events industry in the United States. The result is that fans pay more in fees, artists have fewer opportunities to play concerts, smaller promoters get squeezed out, and venues have fewer real choices for ticketing services. It's time to break up Live Nation Ticketmaster," end quote. Live Nation, for their part, called the DOJ allegations of a monopoly, quote, absurd. Ticketmaster has faced antitrust allegations going back to 1994. The Department of Justice intervened in antitrust questions with Live Nation and Ticketmaster in the past. In 2019, the DOJ claimed Live Nation had violated its merger agreement by compelling venues to use Ticketmaster. Live Nation agreed to heighten measures and penalties, but critics found this arrangement ineffective and called for more serious antitrust measures, like the breakup of Live Nation and Ticketmaster. Looking at antitrust case precedent, the litigation of a possible lawsuit could take years. The House GOP moves to strike mention of Trump's criminal trial from the record, and his former rival Nikki Haley endorses him. Meanwhile, Ohio Republicans reject a legislative fix to ensure Biden's name appears on the November ballot. With more on those stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We have a presumptive nominee for president facing 88 felony counts, and we're being prevented from even acknowledging it. These are not alternative facts. These are real facts.
Massachusetts Democrat Jim McGovern says telling the truth about former President Donald Trump's criminal cases should not be against House rules. His words were stricken from the record Wednesday after Republicans accused him of making personal attacks during a debate on voting legislation. McGovern notes that House leadership has ruled you can talk about the trial as long as you call it a sham. Former Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley says she wants a president who will secure the border and support capitalism and freedom. She says Trump isn't perfect, but calls Biden a catastrophe. But her endorsement comes with a warning.
Trump would be smart to reach out to the millions of people who voted for me and continue to support me, and not assume that they're just going to be with him.
Haley took a fifth of the votes in recent primaries in Arizona and Pennsylvania. Meanwhile, the Trump campaign says he misspoke when telling a Pittsburgh TV station that states restricting contraceptives could be making a smart decision. During the interview, he refused to give his personal views.
Well, we're looking at that, and I'm going to have a policy on that very shortly. And I think it's something that you'll find interesting.
Hours later, Trump reversed course, saying he doesn't favor restrictions on birth control. A spokesperson says he was referring to a coming announcement about abortion medication. And Louisiana lawmakers already look likely to restrict them, advancing a bill that puts the two most common abortion drugs in the same category as opioids. A lease degree with the New Orleans nonprofit Women with a Vision says those without a valid prescription could face jail.
This legislation is completely unnecessary in a state where abortion care is already criminalized. It will have healthcare providers in a bind, scared of criminalization, not only for themselves, for their patients.
Ohio's House leaders say the GOP-led body lacks the political will to ensure President Biden's name appears on November's ballot. State law requires parties certify their candidates by August 7th, 2 weeks before the Democratic convention. Republican Senate President Matt Huffman says the DNC could use provisional certification.
it's sort of, I guess, an interesting story that it sounds like Republicans are going to keep Joe Biden off the ballot. That's false. It's not going to happen, but gives everybody something to talk about for a couple months.
The New York Times reports Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito flew another flag associated with the January 6th insurrection. The Revolutionary War Appeal to Heaven flag flown over his beach house last year is associated with the religious branch of the Stop the Steal movement. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $60,000 by May 25th. We'd like to remind you that you can become a member at any time during this broadcast by going online to bit.ly/KBOO. You can also text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Your weather forecast, cloudy with an overnight low of 45. Tomorrow, clouds continue with a daytime high of 63. Today in history, in 1829, a patent for the accordion is granted to Cyril Demian in Vienna. The instrument spread widely across the world as a result of European migration. The quote of the day is from American journalist and women's rights advocate Margaret Fuller, born this day in 1810. She said, quote, "To one who has enjoyed the full life of any scene, of any hour, what thoughts can be recorded about it seem like the commas and semicolons in the paragraph, mere stops." The U.S. Secretary of Veterans Affairs headlined the National Tribal Healthcare Conference in South Dakota this year. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. The National Tribal Healthcare Conference was held in Rapid City this year, a major event for the Monument Theater downtown. With 1,600 attendees, the event also brought key figures from D.C. SDPB's C.J. Keene has more.
U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Secretary Dennis McDonough spoke to attendees about the current administration's priorities relating to veterans, with a particular emphasis on Indigenous perspectives.
You remember, back in November 22, I made a commitment to you guys. I said we'd have the copay exemption in place for American Indian and Alaska Natives by year's end. We missed it by a couple months, but we got it done last spring, and it's making a difference. Over 6,000 vets have applied for the waiver.
Despite that early success, McDonough says there are over 60,000 eligible Native veterans who still haven't applied for these benefits.
My concern is how many Native vets just don't know that there's this benefit waiting for them. And I want to ask for your help. That's the same approach we're taking on reimbursement payments, expanding the scope of support to Native vets.
Information for how to apply can be found online. Another current priority for the VA is to expand access to traditional medicine and mental health treatment for Indigenous vets.
When I talk about meeting vets where they are, I'm talking spiritually, mentally, culturally as well. Now, we already offer traditional medicine at some of our facilities, but we need more formal recognition and integration of traditional healing as part of our healthcare programs. So, IHS Director Rosalind Soh is fighting alongside us.
Also near the top of the priority list is rural outreach, particularly on reservation settings. For National Native News, I'm C.J. Keene in Rapid City.
The Lac Du Flambeau tribe says the federal government should be providing millions more in funding to combat the tribe's drug issues and their consequences. Over the last 6 years, the 11-member tribal police department has made more than 2,000 arrests. Fully half have been drug-related. But overworked law enforcement is only one challenge presented by drugs. Ben Meyer explains.
Lac-Da-Flambeau Tribal President George Thompson said meth, heroin, and fentanyl addictions are driving the mental health crisis and spurring human trafficking on the reservation. Drug addiction has also had a major impact on housing.
We were at a point with the amount of drug use, it damn near bankrupted our housing authority. And it still continues to hurt our housing authority.
Thompson testified earlier this month in Washington before the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Interior, Environment, and Related Agencies. He was one of many tribal officials from across the country to do so. Thompson said federal laws are written in a way that inhibits federal funding from being used to clean up drug houses on the reservation.
It costs the tribe at least $4,000 to $8,000 to clean and test a meth-contaminated home. We are losing our housing inventory due to drugs. This is causing overcrowding and domestic and child abuse.
Thompson wants Congress to rewrite the law to allow for cleanup funding to flow more easily. He also said cartels are now bringing drugs directly to the reservation. To fight these issues, Thompson said the federal government should be sending millions more to Lac-Da-Flambeau to uphold the government's trust responsibility to the tribe. For National Native News, I'm Ben Meyer.
I'm Jill Freitas.
Black voters around the country are poised to play a key role in the 2024 election. In fact, one expert says black people should not be considered a monolith as they hold a wide range of ideological views. Alex Gonzalez has more in Nevada.
Black voters will play a key role in determining who will win the 2024 presidential election. And while black voters remain overwhelmingly Democratic and support President Joe Biden over former President Donald Trump, Biden's edge over Trump is changing. A new poll shows Trump ahead of Biden in five crucial battleground states, one being Nevada, over discontent about the economy and the war in Gaza, especially among young voters of color. Rashawn Ray with the Brookings Institution says contrary to a popular misconception, black voters are not a monolith and do turn out to vote, with 2024 being no exception.
Oftentimes they are choosing between the lesser of two evils, because we have an overly simplistic two-party system. And then the other part of this, there are some people who would rather stay at home than vote for someone who they don't think aligns with their particular politics and their cultural values.
Ray says the narrative that black people don't vote is simply not true. Eligible black voters stand out for higher turnout rates than their Latino and Asian counterparts, according to Pew Research Center. They also tend to be younger than voters overall, with about 60% of eligible black voters being under the age of 50. Project director with the nonprofit organization Black Girls Vote, Ashley C.J. Daniels, calls black women a powerhouse behind Democratic Party wins and adds that many have gotten politically engaged, especially since 2020. But she adds that researchers like her know there is what she calls an enthusiasm gap in the 2024 election.
Looking at some of, like, you know, the data, you have, you know, numerous reasons why that there is an enthusiasm gap. You have, you know, some black folks that are concerned about the ceasefire, you know, that's going on in Gaza. And you have some black folks that are concerned about reproductive justice. You have others that are concerned about economics. So there's like a variance.
Daniel says it's important politicians understand that the black vote is more complex than was previously considered. Black voters hold a range of ideologies, including conservative views, that account for about 10% of black voters consistently voting for Republican candidates. For Nevada News Service, I'm Alex Gonzalez. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
More than a decade after the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program began, this month, the Biden administration has expanded health coverage to members of that group. This could affect more than 500,000 people across the United States, and especially communities with high immigrant populations. Kathleen Shannon reports from Wyoming.
The Biden administration finalized a rule that will expand health care coverage to Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA recipients, who will now fall into the lawfully present category. In Wyoming, the tourist economy in Jackson Hole attracts immigrants looking for work. It's hard to pin down how many people that is, but some estimates say immigrants make up a quarter of the regional population. According to Aline Yoriko Bedillo Carrillo with Voices Jackson Hole, an organization that amplifies immigrant voices, she says immigrants work many jobs vital to tourist hotspots.
Service industry and housekeeping, restaurant services, construction, a lot of the heavy lifting to ensure our community keeps on running.
More than 500,000 DACA recipients are currently in the United States, according to Immigration Services, and they are three times more likely to be uninsured than the general population. The DACA program, started in 2012, gives protections to certain undocumented immigrants arriving to the U.S. as children. But before now, those protections haven't included access to health coverage through the Affordable Care Act marketplace or the Basic Health Program. Badillo Carrillo herself is a DACA recipient and says the benefits of health coverage are far-reaching.
Not just for me, but I think it's a communal benefit. If I have access to preventative care and access to medical care, then I'll be able to be healthier and then I'll be able to help others also.
The rule goes into effect November 1st, at the same time the enrollment period begins. I'm Kathleen Shannon reporting for Wyoming News Service.
May is Women's Health Month, and one focus this month has been on the more than 26 million women in the U.S. who are affected by fibroids. These benign growths are common, yet often unknown to people who have them, and medical professionals are urging women to educate themselves about treatment options, including minimally invasive procedures. Farah Siddiqui reports on what's being done to raise awareness.
This is Women's Health Month, and more than 26 million women in the United States have fibroids. Fibroids are benign growths typically in the uterus and reproductive organs, and fewer than half of the people diagnosed have even heard of them. In Missouri, state law since 2009 permits the health department to disseminate information about fibroids and treatment options. Dr. Jan Katznelson, founder of the nonprofit Fibroid Fighters, says fibroids should not limit anyone living life to its fullest potential. He adds, although many women can be symptom-free, about half will experience fibroid-related health concerns.
It's typically presented with this prolonged and heavy menstrual period, frequent urination, bloating, pain during intercourse, and very often with miscarriages. It's extremely common.
Fibroids are easily diagnosed with an ultrasound. Up to 70% of white women and over 80% of black women in the U.S. have uterine fibroids, making the condition more prevalent than high blood pressure and breast or ovarian cancer. Fibroid patient Mallory Bailey describes her symptoms.
I refused to have the hysterectomy, and I said, okay, well, I'll be 50 soon. I guess the menopause probably would stop it. In my case, it didn't. It got worse, still bleeding, and it went from, I started changing every 10 minutes for 5 days.
In past years, the primary treatment for fibroids was a hysterectomy. But Jacob White, an interventional radiologist at the USA Fibroid Center in New York City, says that is no longer the case.
You have to know your options. You have to make sure you do your own research, be your own advocate, and get second and third opinions to make sure you know all the treatment options available to you so you can make an informed decision. Otherwise, you may not learn about the minimally invasive treatment options like uterine fibroid embolization.
Even Congress has taken up the issue of fibroids with legislation in the House last year that would have boosted fibroid research and education. It had more than 80 co-sponsors, including Missouri Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, but the bill did not advance. For Missouri News Service, I'm Farah Siddiqui.
To create awareness and inspire action, two high-profile chefs are putting together meals featuring coffee, chocolate, and other foods that will become more costly and difficult to produce because of climate change. Mike Moen has the details in Minnesota.
Climate change experts warn that a warming planet threatens global food supplies. Some famous chefs, including one from Minnesota, are trying to educate more people while serving them luxurious menu items. Andrew Zimmern and fellow culinary standout Sam Cass have been hosting occasional dinners, and a recent one in Minneapolis featured dishes crafted from what experts believe to be near-extinct ingredients. The duo warns that if there isn't enough progress in reversing the effects of climate change, beloved staples such as chocolate and coffee will be out of reach for many people. Margaret Klein-Salomon of the Climate Emergency Fund says this approach can be helpful, with a major caveat.
If they're using those dinners to tell the truth about the climate emergency and the fact that everyone in the world is threatened by this, not in some kind of faraway future, I think it could be great.
Attendees paid $285 for the Minneapolis event, and Cass said he hopes the crowd walked away inspired to make changes through actions such as donations. Talking to family members and co-workers who deny climate change, eating less meat were other suggestions, along with conversations about solutions taking shape in the business world. Salomon feels there are more effective ways to get the point across about how warming temperatures and food production overlap, with an emphasis on basic staples such as wheat and rice being affected.
Climate Emergency Fund supports disruptive climate activism. So activists who go to politicians, oil executives, speeches or panel discussions or book launch or award ceremony, and they disrupt them.
She acknowledges that someone throwing soup on a painting in an art museum won't be popular, but she adds that's not the goal, noting the purpose is for the public to think more about the issue, even if they're annoyed. However, observers say the dinner event's less-than-disruptive message seemed to resonate with the guests. This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection. This story was produced with original reporting from Cinnamon Janzer for Civil Eats.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 23rd, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, and ideas at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertoff, Reed Johnson, and Doug McVeigh. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Alex Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Jill Freitas, Farah Siddiqui, and Kathleen Shannon. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and now is a great time to join because we can't do this without you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go online to bit.ly/KBOO or just text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for the Global Citizen International Digest. Have a good night. We'll be right back.